So we've looked at the opening verses of Paul's letter to the Romans. Many of you have been here for that. And what I want us to do this evening then is to move on to this main section of the first chapter from verse 18 to verse 32. And perhaps the best way to go about this is to just go back to verse 16 and 17. First of all, that's why I read them just now. Paul wants to stress to the Romans then how he's not ashamed of the gospel or the good news. I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. First for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. And that, if you like, then is a brief summary of what this letter is mainly about. It's a brief summary of the gospel that Paul proclaimed. And so having put this, it's like a heading if you want, having put this heading up, he now begins to expound the gospel, the good news. And you notice he starts with the wrath of God. That's where he starts. When he wants to talk about the good news, he begins with the bad news. He begins with what he has to say about the wrath of God. And that might surprise us a little bit. But I think if you look at those verses, you'll see the order. You see, he talks about the gospel. What is the gospel, Paul? Well, he says it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. And you say, well, how is that then, Paul? Well, in the gospel, he says, a righteousness from God is revealed. A righteousness is by faith from first to last. So the gospel reveals a righteousness. But why do we need this righteousness? Well, because, and the NIV has sort of slipped up there, really. I think somehow they should have got an extra word there at the beginning of verse 18 to show you that, although certainly in my version you've got a long gap between verse 17 and verse 18 on the page, really it does follow on. The righteous will live by faith, those verses, and then because, really we could translate it, because, for, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. So it's because of the wrath of God that this righteousness is necessary. And he goes on then to begin to answer the question of how people have suppressed the truth in verse 19 and 20 when he says, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world then, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature, those things have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. And so men are without excuse, says Paul. So you see the way he gets to this subject. It's not, it shouldn't be a surprise to us at all. And so he begins then to open up an extended treatment of what life, especially in the Gentile world, of that time was really like. And I think the saddest thing when you read this chapter is that it reminds you of our own society. I think our society is very much like the one that Paul is describing here, one that is under the wrath of God. And so before we come then to the wonderful gospel, it is a wonderful gospel, we need to talk about the wrath of God first of all. So I want to say a number of things to you. First of all, I want to say this. Understand that there is such a thing as the wrath of God. I think that's where we need to start, isn't it? There is such a thing as the wrath of God. Paul uses this phrase, doesn't he? The wrath of God. The wrath of God. Well, what does he mean by the wrath of God? Well, we're talking here about God's settled anger. God's stern opposition to certain things. We mustn't confuse it with human anger. Human anger is very often out of control. It gets very easily out of control. But it exists in God, even though we've got these inferior versions of wrath, if you like. It exists in perfection in God, as this verse makes clear. Now, it's true that this is the only time we've got the phrase in Romans, the wrath of God. Paul doesn't use the phrase, the wrath of God, very often. He more often speaks about the wrath, just the wrath. But I don't think you can argue, as some try and argue, that it's just a sort of an inevitable process in reaction to sin that we're talking about. It isn't simply then, you know, sin is the cause, disaster the effect, some sort of automatic thing. I think this is personal, isn't it? And just as God's grace then, we read about God's grace, although more often we read about the grace. Just as God's grace is something personal, so we have to say God's wrath is something personal. So you understand what we're saying? It doesn't mean to say that God loses his temper, or that God flies into a rage, or that God acts in a spiteful way. That's not what we mean by the wrath of God. But we do mean then that there is a holy hostility towards evil, then a righteous, a perfectly righteous indignation. You know, God isn't neutral. It isn't that God's just open. No, God is love. We have to say that. That's clear from Scripture. And yet, there is also such a thing as the wrath of God, his wrath against evil. And so we need to realize that there is such a thing as the wrath of God, his settled and righteous indignation. So that's the first thing. Understand that there is such a thing as the wrath of God. And then secondly, realize that it is being revealed from heaven. Realize it is being revealed from heaven. You see, Paul says about this wrath then, the wrath of God, he says, is being revealed from heaven. Now that's interesting, isn't it? He doesn't say it has been revealed, which I suppose is true. He doesn't say it's going to be revealed, which is also very much true. But what he says then is that it is being revealed. There's a present aspect then about the wrath of God. Quite apart from anything in the past or in the future, there is a present aspect that is already coming on this world. Paul has already said that in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed. But here he says that wrath is also being revealed from heaven. Which is another way of saying from God himself, isn't it? When he says from heaven, he means from God himself. And so God's wrath is not a human discovery, is it? It's something that God reveals, that God shows. And these two things then, his righteousness and his wrath, are, well, as one commentator puts it, they are present realities, not remote possibilities. When we talk about the wrath of God, we're not saying, well, that's something that, ooh, there are times when it happens. No, no, it's something that's a present reality. So it's not just something in the past, it's not just something in the future, it is something that is being revealed even today, in these last days. So understand that there's such a thing as the wrath of God. Realize it is being revealed from heaven. Thirdly, understand what it is directed against. What is this wrath directed at then? What does it aim at? Well, God's anger, as we said, isn't aroused then by some sort of personal pique. It's specifically against evil. The wrath of God, Paul says, is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. So there are two things here then, aren't there? There's godlessness and there's wickedness. And I think probably Paul is thinking, first of all, particularly about sins against God. Sins, as we say, from the first table of the law, isn't it? Misusing God's name, failing to put him first, worshipping idols, not keeping his day. Those sorts of sins. There's godlessness and then there's wickedness, which is sins against our fellow men. The second table of the law, stealing and committing adultery and coveting and telling lies and all those other things that come under those main headings. The one sin, of course, leads to the other. Now, I know there are many people who want to say to you, you can be good and not believe in God. You can be good and not be religious. And yet, I think all the evidence points in the other direction. The two things are integrated. The two things are tied together. And you notice then that it is not just against man's godlessness or wickedness in a general way that God's wrath is directed, but particularly in the way that this activity then involves men suppressing the truth by their wickedness. It's not just that people do wrong, although they should know better than to do wrong. Their godlessness and their wickedness springs out of a determination to stifle the truth and to live for themselves rather than living for God. They suppress the truth, or they hold it down. You know, you've been to the seaside perhaps this summer and you had a nice ball, or perhaps you've done it, you have to think back a few years since you last did this, but you press the ball down into the water, isn't it? There's something that makes it bob up, but you keep trying to press it down. Well, that's what people do with the knowledge of God then. They try and stifle it. They try and choke it. They try and keep the lid on the box. When we meet people, we must remember this. Now, I know you don't meet many people who are outright and say, well, I don't believe in God. Although you meet some, don't you? Most people say, well, I think there probably is something there. That's usually the way they express it. But you must understand what's going on. They know. They know there's a God. You've never met a person who doesn't know that there's a God. We all know. We all know there's a God. But we try and suppress that knowledge. That's what we do by nature then. We try and push it out of our minds. We try and keep it out of our thinking. We try to keep it there in the background. It keeps trying to leap out, but there's this attempt to suppress it. And we need to understand then that that's what's going on in men's hearts, the hearts of men and women and boys and girls. So that's the third thing then, isn't it? Understand that God's wrath is directed then against godlessness and wickedness, and particularly against godlessness and wickedness as it springs then from this determination to suppress the truth. That's the focus of God's wrath. That's what God hates. It is a denial of the plain truth, and God is opposed to that. God is full of wrath against that. So then fourthly, let's say this. Understand then why. Understand why it is being revealed. You see, in verse 19, Paul goes on to explain the sort of stifling of the truth that he has in mind. He says that the reason why God's wrath is being revealed against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness is, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. Now obviously only certain things can be known about God by finite minds like our own. But certain things are known. They are plain to see, says Paul. God has made these things plain. Well, how has he made them plain? Well, particularly here, Paul thinks of the creation. Verse 20 says, since the creation of the world, since the very beginning, God's invisible qualities then, his eternal power, his divine nature, things like that then, they have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. The very creation around us shows us that there's a God, so that men are without excuse. God by nature is invisible. You can't see God, of course. And you can't know God by making your own efforts to know God. But God has, as it were, he's made himself visible. He has made himself known. He's revealed himself. And he's done that particularly in the creation that is all around us. And we often refer to this as God's general revelation. I mean, obviously God has made a revelation of himself in the Bible. But not everybody has got a Bible. Not everybody reads the Bible. But that doesn't leave them with any excuse, because God has also revealed himself in a general way then, through the creation. That's true of every single person who comes into this world. Every human being can see this, at least to some extent. It's sometimes called natural revelation, because it's through nature then that this revelation comes, this creation all around us. And it is something then that's gone on since the creation itself then. And it is especially seen, it's seen in other ways, but it's especially seen in the created order. And so if you study the creation itself then, you will be confronted with clear evidence for God. His eternal power, his divine nature, for example, as Paul mentions here. And that's why at the judgment then people will be without excuse. They do know enough about God to leave them without excuse. There's no excuse for not believing in God. There's enough evidence for people to see that. You think about it. Can you sit through a thunderstorm? Can you sit through an earthquake? You can't sit through an earthquake, probably. You want to get somewhere safe. Can you do that and doubt the power of God? Can you look at all the wonders of nature then? You think of the tiniest amoeba, the movement of a butterfly or a hummingbird, the birth of a baby, the flight of an eagle, the charge of an elephant, the eruption of a volcano. Can you think about those things without seeing that there is a divine being behind it all? There is a God. Now, I trust that most of you, if not all of you, would say, well, yeah, obviously there's a God. But then you say, well, but I have met people, and they've seen those sorts of things, and they don't believe in God. They don't believe in God. Well, why don't they believe in God? Well, the answer's here, isn't it? The only way you can get through all those things, the only way you can be alive in this creation and not accept that there's a God is by suppressing it, holding down the truth. That's the only way that it can be done, holding down, suppressing the truth with your wickedness. And so that's why God's wrath is being revealed then. Because, take verse 21 to confirm it to you, although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and empty, pointless. And their foolish hearts were darkened. You know, that's the position today, is it? Richard Dawkins knows there's a God. I love that story about Kingsley Amis, the novelist. Kingsley Amis was a well-known atheist, and somebody said to him once, you are an atheist, aren't you? He said, it's worse than that, he said. It's not just that I don't believe in God, I hate him, he said. Which is a strange thing to say, but perhaps it was one of those Freudian slips, as they call them, where he really told the truth, isn't it? I mean, that's the truth about Richard Dawkins, isn't it? It's not that he doesn't believe in God. The fact is, he hates God. He hates God. And he wants to do everything he can to destroy trust in him and following him. You know there's a God. Everyone we meet, they know there's a God. But by nature, then, we suppress, we hold down that truth. We know there's a God. But by nature, we refuse to give him the glory. We refuse to thank him that we're alive, that he has blessed us in so many ways. And you think in your futile way and in your foolish and dark heart then that you are making some great progress, but you're not making any progress at all. And there's no excuse. There's no excuse for that. When we all stand before God then to be judged, nobody is going to say, oh, but I didn't believe in you, so you can't punish me because I didn't believe in you. Yes, you do. You did. You know you did. You know, remember Sarah when she lied, isn't it? And she was confronted. You lied. Oh, I didn't lie, she said. I didn't lie. You did. You did. And every person we meet, they know. They know that there's a God. And they're without excuse. And so we need to understand then, not only that there is such a thing as the wrath of God, and that it is already being revealed from heaven, and who it's directed against and why it's being revealed. But we need to understand how it is being revealed. This is the last point, but it's a point I want to spend some time on. This is the last but one point, which I want to be quite brief on this, and then I want to be a little lengthy on the last point. So understand how it is being revealed. Now, obviously, God's wrath is going to be revealed at the end of time, isn't it? There's going to be a great judgment then. The wrath of God will be revealed. And, for example, in Romans 13, Paul talks about how the powers that be then, they are messengers of the wrath of God. Justice then. When a person is, when he does something wrong and he's put in prison or he's punished in some other way, that's the wrath of God against him. So it is being revealed in those ways already. But here Paul says that even now, God reveals his wrath at the present, his wrath from heaven in this particular way. And he uses the phrase three times. Perhaps you noticed this as we were reading it. Perhaps if you've got your Bible open to Romans chapter 1, you can just pick them out. You might, well, you can't underline them if they're church Bibles, but you can underline them if it's your own Bible. But it's verse 24, first of all. Therefore, God, is that those three words, gave them over. God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. And then in verse 26, because of this, God, there it is again, gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. And then finally in verse 28, furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. Now that might come as a bit of a surprise to us. It's not a loud and, you know, booming thing, is it? It's not bombs being lobbed on us. It isn't like that. It's not like a thunderbolt coming from heaven. It's something quiet, something invisible. It's like poisonous gas, I suppose. It's got that quality to it. It works then, not by God intervening, but by God refusing to intervene. I suppose you sometimes, as a parent, you will do this, isn't it? Normally, there's a problem, you intervene, you deal with it. But sometimes, there's a way of teaching a child a lesson by just leaving them to carry on with what they're doing. And God's wrath then is a little bit like that then. Now, it's seen, firstly, God's wrath then, before we come to that great day of judgment, in the spiritual and the moral degeneration which we see so often in this world. So that's how it's being revealed. And then that brings us on to this final point. I want us to consider this pattern that Paul shows us then in the verses that remain. This pattern in the revelation of God's wrath. So the rest of the chapter really has three descriptions of this threefold process that he's spoken of already. So, you know, first of all, we have the fact that people have a knowledge of God to some extent, isn't it? Verse 21, they knew God, he says. Verse 25, they exchanged the truth of God. That's what they had then, the truth of God, but they exchanged that for something else. And then verse 28, they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. They had the knowledge of God, but they didn't think it was something that was worth holding on to. So first of all, there's the fact that people know God, at least to some extent. Secondly, then, there's the way that they nevertheless reject that knowledge in favor of one form of idolatry or another. So verse 21 again, although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, and so on. Verse 25, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And they worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. Amen. And then verse 28, they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. They had the knowledge of God, but they didn't think it was something that they could hold on to. So they know God, but they reject that knowledge in favor of idolatry. And so then, what does God do? Well, this is how he gives them over in wrath then. Verse 24, therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. Verse 26, because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. And verse 28, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. So let's look at these three sections to close then in a little bit more detail. So first of all, verse 21 to verse 24. And this is the rejection of God then that leads to sexual immorality. So Paul is willing to say then of these complete pagans that he's talking about chiefly here, that they know God. Not that they know him in the full sense, of course, but they've got a knowledge of God to some extent. They're aware then of his invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature. These things are clearly seen. They're understood then from what's been made. And so these people are without excuse. But what happens? Well, Paul says of these pagans, although they knew God, they didn't glorify God as God, nor did they give thanks to him. Instead, then, their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. They claimed to be wise, of course. Every generation claims to be wise, doesn't it? No, you know, nobody stands up and saying, I'm an atheist. I know it's a stupid thing to believe, but there we are. That's the way it is. Don't they always say, no, I'm an atheist. This is because I'm such an intelligent person. And they all then claim to be wise in that way, and claims for wisdom shouldn't faze us even for a moment. Instead, then, their thinking became futile, their foolish hearts were darkened. They claimed to be wise, but they became fools. And so Paul puts it this way, then, they exchanged the glory of the immortal God. And he's drawing on Old Testament verses to make this statement. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God, then, for images to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles even. They engaged in idolatry then. Paul was aware of the idolatry that was going on all over the Roman world in his day. I think, you know, if you read anything from the ancient Greeks, their philosophers and their mathematicians and so on, clearly they discovered a lot of things that had to be rediscovered later on. They were wise to a certain extent. But Paul was aware that despite all that wisdom that they undoubtedly had, everywhere he went, there were statues of idols. People would bow down to wood and stone. Paul would see people doing that sort of thing. And as one writer comments, it's the same in Hinduism today. I've told you many times about being in Bombay and seeing men making a god out of the sand. I guess they just did it to make some money, really. But to say that a sandcastle is a god, it is a very strange thing to say. And yet, well, as this one writer puts it, he says that despite the perhaps lofty philosophy that you can find in Hinduism, it utters no effective protest against the most degrading practices of popular religion in India today. And of course, it's not just the ancient Greeks and the Hindus, is it? But it's in our society, isn't it? I mean, it's a little perhaps more refined, the idolatry that goes on in our society. But there's an obsession, isn't it? An obsession with wealth and with fame and with power that is sheer idolatry. We need to recognize that that is the way our society is. So how does God's wrath express itself in situations like this? Well, you see it there in verse 24, isn't it? Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. You know, history shows us again and again that idolatry leads to immorality. A false image of God leads to a false image of sex, a false understanding of sex. And God allows such degradation then as an expression of his wrath. Because sometimes it's difficult to see this, isn't it? You think, well, we know that we live in a society that's obsessed with wealth and power and fame. And we know that there's a great deal of sexual immorality. But it's not often that the connection between those two things is seen. Well, it's the way God gives over a society in his wrath. You know, in effect, God is saying, you want idolatry. You want to live in an idolatrous way. Well, here it is. And what it will lead to is immorality. It will lead to the breakdown of marriages, to adultery, to all sorts of problems we have in our society that really trace back to this sexual immorality. I mentioned this morning how it's nearly half the babies that are born in this country, or in England and Wales at least, that are born outside of wedlock at this stage, and that's bound to do harm to those children in the end. And many humanists, of course, protest against this. They say, no, you can live an idolatrous lifestyle. Don't call it that, but you can live like that, and you don't have to be sexually immoral. And it may be that there are examples you can give of that sort of thing. I suppose Gandhi, people talk about, isn't it? Gandhi often showed off about his power to restrain himself sexually. But very rare examples, really. The normal pattern is that idolatry leads to immorality. And sexual immorality then is a mark of a society under the wrath of God. And it should greatly concern us that we live in a society like that, don't we? You don't have to pick up a newspaper. You don't have to go into a news agency to see what's on the shelves to realise what a society we live in, a society that is clearly under the wrath of God. And it should greatly grieve us and make us sorry that that's the case. So first of all then, you've got this rejection of God that leads to sexual immorality. And then verse 25 to 27, Paul goes through it again and he says it leads also to homosexuality. That's another mark of a society under God's wrath. Verse 25, 26, 27. They exchange the truth of God, says Paul, for a lie. They worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. Amen. And so idolatry in its various forms then is really just a lie, isn't it? It's a false worship. It denies the truth that there is one God and that He made us and that He alone is to be worshipped. You shall have no other gods before me. That's the first commandment, isn't it? And so Paul goes on in verse 26 to say, well, because of this then, because of this idolatry, God gave them over. And this time he talks about shameful lust. He gave them over to shameful lust. He speaks first of all of what today is most often called lesbianism. Even their women, he says, exchange natural relations for unnatural ones. And then he talks about male homosexuality, verse 27. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. Now that last phrase is quite difficult. It's not clear exactly what Paul means there. But he does seem to be saying that there are penalties that are connected with homosexuality. Now, in our day, we immediately think of AIDS or perhaps other sexually transmitted diseases. But I don't think it's just things like that. There are all sorts of sufferings that homosexuals go through because of the chosen lifestyle. Paul refers to them there. And so his point is that these unnatural acts, because they are acts then that wouldn't naturally occur. It's not a natural thing for a man to be with a man. It's a natural thing for a man to be with a woman, but not for a man to be with a man. Acts then that fly in the very face of the created order, they are bound to lead to suffering, Paul says. It shouldn't surprise us that so many who adopt that lifestyle really are, well, they use the name gay, don't they? But so often they're not gay. I'm sure you can find plenty of examples of people who appear then to be very happy, but very often it's not the case. And I don't think it's because they're persecuted or because people like me are saying that they shouldn't be doing that. I think that there are inbuilt problems with that whole choice of lifestyle. I think that's what Paul is saying here. And so this is another expression of God's wrath. You may have heard of what happened in America earlier this year when there was a beauty pageant. And there was a young lady from California, Miss California. She was called Carrie Prejean, or Prejean, I'm not quite how you say that. Not quite sure how you say that. And what happened was that she was asked by a judge what she thought about something that had happened in recent months in Vermont, one of the states in America. They decided to legalize same-sex marriages, as they're called. She was asked what she thought about these same-sex marriages. Should it be brought in all the states in America? What was her opinion? And she said, I believe that a marriage should be between a man and a woman. No offense to anybody here, but that's how I was raised and that's how I think it should be, between a man and a woman. And there were boos and there were cheers from the audience who were present to hear that. But there was a lot of offense caused by the fact that she said what she said. And in fact, I think I'm right in saying she was put out of the competition. Perhaps she had a blessing in disguise that I don't know, but she was put out of the competition for those remarks. And she was vilified in many places, including in Britain, for what she said. Now imagine if she'd said what Paul says here. Because Paul doesn't just say that homosexuality is wrong, which is basically what she was saying. Paul says that it is a mark that the wrath of God has come. Now that's very difficult, isn't it? If you know homosexuals, or if you meet them, it's not the thing you're going to begin with, is it? But they may ask you, and you may find yourself. But I think we have to be honest and say that is the way that the Bible explains it. That's the way that the Bible understands it. Not only that homosexuality is wrong, but it is a mark that the wrath of God has come. I think that's certainly what Paul is saying here. People have tried to argue around it, but I think I'm not going to waste your time with the arguments because they really just don't stand up. When people in a place then prefer a lie to the truth of God, then they will fall not only into sexual perversion, but male and female homosexuality as well. And far from being a good thing, this is a bad thing indeed. It's unnatural, it leads to many sorrows, and it brings the wrath of God. It is the wrath of God, that's what it is. And so the prevalence of sexual immorality then is a mark of a society under God's wrath. And the prevalence of homosexuality is a further mark of a society under God's wrath. And it should greatly concern us that we live in a society like that. Like that. Because sometimes you wonder, where is all this coming from? Why is this happening? Well, it's because we're under the wrath of God. And then finally, Paul talks about the way the rejection of God leads to depravity of all sorts. Final section from verse 28 then. Furthermore, says Paul, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. There's a little play on words there. It's something like, since they did not see fit to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to an unfit mind. Since they did not see fit to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to an unfit mind. Now this unfit, this depraved mind then, led them not just into sexual immorality and into homosexuality, but all sorts of other things. Things that ought not to be done. All sorts of antisocial practices, such as those who are listed here. And so that's why we've got to be careful, isn't it? Paul does single out sexual perversion, particularly homosexuality, but he's got a whole list of other things. 21 different items are listed here. Now, lists are popular today, and they were popular in Paul's time as well, in the ancient world. Paul then has put this list together, and it's not entirely clear how he gets this particular list, but I think you can probably split it up something like this. First of all, there are four general sins. Things that fill people. They are filled, he says, or they've become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. Isn't it? I don't think you can sharply distinguish those things. What's the difference between wickedness and evil? I suppose evil is a sort of a step further. You sometimes hear them debate on the radio or television. Is there such a thing as evil? They seem to have some sort of doubt about it. And it happens when we get particularly evil crimes. So you can see a distinction between wickedness and evil, but really these are general words. And then he talks about five specific sins. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. And these are, again, things that we can read about in our newspapers and that we know are going on a daily basis in our society. He mentions two sins of speech then. Thirdly, they are gossips and slanderers. Gossip is a sin. It goes on at various levels in our society today and causes a lot of unhappiness and harm. We mustn't be gossips, must we? And slander, of course. People seem quite prepared to say things that are either not true or that are just designed to drag the person down. It's again a mark of our society. Then we've got four sins of pride. These people are God-haters. They are insolent. They are arrogant. They are boastful. Now again, boasting is thought not to be a great sin in our society. That's a frightening thought, isn't it? That people don't even see that it is a great sin to boast. And we must turn from all sins of pride. And then he mentions two more specific sins. He mentions that they invent ways of doing evil. I find that a fascinating phrase, isn't it? But it is a mark of a society under the wrath of God, where it's not just that people are committing the same old sins that they've always committed, but they're trying to think up new sins. And, you know, you think of the way that computers then have become part of our daily lives. And there are a lot of people out there, and they're trying to think of ways then to take advantage of people through the computer. And it's a pretty regular news item, isn't it? The way people have come up with scams and tricks then to deprive people of their money, particularly their money, but also other crimes against them by the use of the computer. People are thinking of ways. The terrorists, they're thinking, and this is frightening, isn't it? Night and day, they're trying to think of ways that they can blow people up successfully. And so, you know, they think of putting it in a shoe, or they think of getting two different liquids and be able to mix them together once you're on the plane. And just this week, there seems to be a case where a man has had the bomb inside him. And if the bomb is inside him, then he can much more easily get onto the plane without being detected. And obviously he blows himself up, but that seems to be, people seem to be quite willing for various reasons to do that. So it's frightening, isn't it? Men invent. They think up ways of doing evil. And then you think of the sin that lies next to it. Disobeying your parents is not such a bad thing, but that's one of the biggest problems we've got in this country. The children don't obey their parents, and people are tearing their hair out. They don't know what to do. People are telling us you mustn't smack children. So already many parents are on the back foot. They can't even punish the children. The children know. They're not stupid. Hey, no smacks, no punishments. This is brilliant. And one of the great problems that we have is disobedience of parents. And then there are four final general sins that are expressed in a negative way. They are senseless. They just don't think. Faithless. They don't stick. They say, yes, I will take this man. And then you don't know how long that marriage is going to last. And they're faithless in business and faithless in all sorts of other ways. Heartless then. They don't care. Ruthless. They will destroy you if you give them a chance. And all such sins, they mark a society under God's wrath. And it's a fearful thing to read a list like that. And so Paul, finally, he makes this comment, verse 32, although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but they also approve of those who practice them. Such sinners then, on the one hand, they know right from wrong. They know what's right. They know what God requires. They know the penalty for disobedience. Their consciences tell them God will judge them for those sins. You know the truth just as I do. And yet they disregard that knowledge. Not only do they do such things, but they encourage others to do the same sort of things. And that's what we're like by nature. We do evil, and in our perversity we encourage others to join in. And Paul isn't exaggerating. There are similar descriptions as this one in ancient writings from the time as well. And these are fearful words when we consider then that this is an expression of the wrath of God. And therefore we need urgently to repent and to encourage others to repent as well. We shouldn't envy sinners, should we? You know, sometimes you're tempted to do that. You say, well, they're just free to sin. But if God lets you go, maybe you think like that. You say, well, I wish God would let me go. Don't wish for that. Don't wish for that. Every time you're thwarted in your attempts to sin, oh, give thanks to God. Oh, I'm glad I wasn't able to do that. I'm glad I wasn't able to go on in that sin. Because if you are, the further you're able to get in your sins, the clearer mark it is that you are under the wrath of God. To go on in sin is to be given over to God's wrath, something that none of us should wish for.